WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. If you read between the lines of Phil Ramone's resume, you'll get a history of modern recording techniques. He started his career as an engineer, recording singers like Leslie Gore, Dusty Springfield, and Dionne Warwick. He went on to produce recordings by Paul Simon, Billy Joel, Barbra Streisand, and Paul McCartney, as well as the original cast recording of Stephen Sondheim's Passion. Ramone pioneered long-distance recording techniques when he produced Frank Sinatra's Duets albums. I spoke with him on his recent trip to Philadelphia, where he had come to produce a recording featuring the Symphony Orchestra of the Curtis Institute of Music, conducted by Andre Previn. We started with one of the records Phil Ramone worked on at the beginning of his career, Leslie Gore's You Don't Own Me.
You don't own me. Just one of your many toys. You don't own me. Don't say I can't go with other boys. And don't tell me what to do. Don't tell me what to say. And please, when I go out with you, don't put me on display.
Phil Ramone, welcome to Fresh Air. What was your role on You Don't Own Me?
I was the recording engineer, working with Quincy Jones, who was the producer, and Leslie, who I think was 14, maybe 15 at the time. It was one of those overnight amazing records for both. I think we had done Judy's Turn to Cry first, and It's My Party was her first hit. And within a week, they believed that she was going to become a star. So the rush was on to record these songs. And we were in an old recording studio, which was a wonderful old room.
So did you record everybody together, or did you bring them in at separate times?
No.
It was all together.
Yeah. As opposite as it is in the 90s, it's just the way it was then. I mean, bands, recording orchestras, rhythm sections were particular groups of people who were brought together who played well together. And it was very much an in thing to have certain kind of rhythm players for this kind of music, the triplets in the right hand of the piano. Maybe one of the greatest jazz pianists. You never know who was in the band. Strings always showed up with the cigars in their mouth and the newspapers and played incredibly well, bored to tears with this kind of music at the time. It's a very funny attitude because people... It wasn't about money. It was about the fact that that was an elite group of people who played that kind of, not just that kind of music. They'd gone from that to a Johnny Mathis session or Rosie Clooney or a play with Toscanini during the week.
So were these string session players, or were they were players from orchestras that would come in to do sessions?
They were great. They were an interesting group of people because they were the mixture. We used to talk about how tough they were because they didn't have much patience. And if you were an engineer, if they didn't hear themselves well or something, we never used earphones in those days. People had to play acoustically in a room. There's a big difference to what was happening. At the time, I had designed this funny little booth to isolate the singer from the band, and it was sort of considered a little bit out there. But it really helped, and mainly because we needed to get some kind of attitude going. In those days, it was also illegal to overdub. And overdub meaning to put your voice on after the orchestra had left.
Why was it illegal?
Well, it was just a union rule. I mean, you performed, you recorded, and you were done. And many things were done behind locked doors later because eventually certain singers were not comfortable singing live. So... it's a funny old story, but the producer would say to me, make sure we have a clean vocal so we can change it. And that's hence the building of booths.
Right, you needed an isolated booth for the singer so that you could re-record their vocal without
right.
And also that you control their volume without also controlling the volume of the orchestra.
Right. I mean, sometimes the band got so loud in the room... you know, any singer could be overwhelmed by the band.
I'd like you to describe what the control room was like when you first started engineering.
Studios were rather simplistic. They did not do multi-track recordings when I started. It was two-track was a big deal. Three-track machine came along, and it was still used as a backup. The key to it was mono, believe it or not. The studio I worked at was a demo studio first. And you'd come in with a song, and we were capable, because there was a bass player and a guitar player and a piano player, to create a demo for you in 15 minutes. And we would double track, meaning we would add, I'd play six fiddle parts in a minute. Like just.
Oh, you'd do the parts yourself?
Oh, sure.
For the demo?
Yeah. It taught me, you know, and engineer it yourself. So you run between the room and you start the machine and you run out there and you've got one bar to get there. It wasn't a very large studio, so. But the combination of doing that taught me so much about all of the intricacies and the lack of what tape could do or couldn't do. We also had to cut our own discs, because that was the way in which the studio operated. And they tried to get as many sessions per day as possible. It cost the person maybe $20 for the whole thing, including paying us. So if we got out of there at $25 a half hour, if we made $50 an hour, we were doing very well. At the end of the day, if there was enough dates, the singers would come in and do maybe six songs in an hour or an hour and a half. Some of them were simple. But that the design of that particular moment was very simple, and yet I always felt cheated, because sometimes we make these demos and then the big studios will get it and the producer will go to the big studio and do the same record. And it may be not even better than what we had done.
Did you save your demos?
Yeah, no, actually I didn't. You know, they're acetates probably. Economics were, you kept the tape for a week. If they wanted to pay for storage, $1 a week, they would pay for it for a month. After that, it went into the reuse file.
Too bad.
Yeah, life was very, very sort of organized in it. But, you know, that pain has hit me twice in my life since then. Once I lost a complete library of a room not too dissimilar to this, where the economic crunch had come and somebody said, you know, we have all those metal reels. So let's go down there and take the metal reels apart. We'll cut the tape off and we'll start with, at least we won't have to pay $2 a reel. So I lost a complete library. I was away working that summer and on some project. It's amazing how...
It hurts me to hear that.
Oh, it kills me. I'm sort of spearheading this at NARIS and trying to get labels and everybody else to pull out tapes. Everybody should pull out tapes and realize that you may have... It's not about money.
Preservation. Yeah.
Yeah, you may have a Dylan rehearsal. Right. God knows what's sitting in somebody's basement.
If you're just joining us, my guest is record producer Phil Ramone. He's worked with a zillion people, including Leslie Gore, Dusty Springfield, Dionne Warwick, Paul Simon, Bob Dylan, Billy Joel, Barbara Streisand, Sinatra, many more. Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with record producer Phil Ramone. One of the trends that you're pioneering now is long-distance recording, like on the two Sinatra duets records. Sinatra records his track, and then somebody comes in and basically phones in their performance. They do it long distance for you from a remote studio location. So they're not only in a separate studio than you are, but they're actually performing with the tape of Sinatra, right?
Right.
As opposed to with Sinatra.
Yeah, but to describe it a little more of the atmosphere, Frank Sinatra, forget about the age, just about the style.
Mm-hmm.
There are 55 players in the room with him. So people forget that Frank is performing his one or two or three takes all in one atmosphere. He's not going to wait for a duet partner to show up, rehearse, do that particular take, maybe do 20 takes. That's something he won't do. He's never been a person to do that. To capture Sinatra at 78 or 79 years old, and you're capturing a master doing his job, he's primed. He comes to work well-prepared. He warms up, and then he sits down, and then he gets on the stool and starts to sing.
But for his duet partner, it's a little like music minus one, isn't it?
Yeah, he knows what they're going to do, but he doesn't know specifically that some lines may change.
Uh-huh.
His instructions were, make them not only equal to the duet, but let them sing in their style, their way, and let them record in their way. Now, most people, you know, are saying, well, why weren't they all in the room? Well, first of all, traveling, putting people, there's 15 artists or 14 artists per album. It's pretty rough to do.
So do you think this kind of long-distance recording, recording from a remote location through fiber optic, is going to really catch on in the recording industry? And if so, what could it be used to do that can't be done now?
Well, for instance, Nashville just came on the line. I was after the people in Nashville to realize how important both ethnic and players that live in specific areas. Everybody sort of thinks everybody gets on an airplane and we all get together in the same room at the same time. It's not always convenient. I did a duet the other day where B.B. King was coming out off of tour, and I was in Los Angeles, and he was, and it was for Peter, Paul, and Mary to sing with Mary. It was just not available to do. Now, we were able to send it back, put the duet together, everybody hearing it as it was happening. They were monitoring what we were doing.
So you recorded real time from a remote
right.
location.
Yeah.
So two people in different locations recorded.
I'm
going
to do
time.
That in middle of May. We're going to go to Singapore to show that we can record live from Real World, which is Peter Gabriel's studio, and a singer in Japan. It's not about a trick. It's not about. It's about allowing yourself. For instance, if I think about a Zydeco player or some accordion player who's sitting in the middle of New Orleans. I can ask for them to go into a studio, and they can join the party, so to speak. It doesn't help your traveling miles, but it sure helps the idea of having people not have to fly to locations all the time. If somebody says, "Listen, I've got a day off and I'm in Chicago, I'd love to sing or play my instrument that day." I mean, I did a Tom Scott saxophone solo. Last February or March, and literally we had 3 hours to figure out what was missing, and we all decided, oh, Tom Scott is the perfect casting. Where is he? He's in L.A. You're in New York. Can we get him? He came into the studio. 20 minutes later, he was out.
I want to ask you about one of the recent recordings that you produced, and this is the recording, the original cast recording of Stephen Sondheim's musical uh-huh. Passion. Wonderful recording.
Thank you.
I think there's a style for doing cast recordings that's maybe different from any other kind of recording.
Oh, yeah.
What's different about it?
You need to record everybody in one day because that's what they give you. One whole day to record everybody. It's exhausting but incredibly challenging. And you create the stage for radio, or like an old radio show on record. And you create the best of those pieces and you edit them quickly to make some kind of sense.
Was Sondheim at your side?
Every minute.
Any interesting advice?
He's a particularly bright, bright man with a tremendous musical taste and a following that'll go on forever.
Phil Ramone, I just have a final question that you've probably been asked a zillion times and might sound really stupid. Do people ever confuse you with either Phil Spector or the Ramones?
You bet. Both of them. I get Phil Spector on the street sometimes, and the Ramones, it's a constant. We went to the MTV Awards this year, and Joey and I sat together. Really bizarre. Oh, it's a constant question.
So what are the mistakes people make?
Well, they think Wall of Sound, Phil Ramone, and it's not. Uh-huh. Phil Spector is definitely, and there's a kind of a decade between us age-wise, I think.
Right, right, right.
And the Ramones, of course, I take full credit for any of their success, and they take it from me, too. We just love, there's an interesting love there. I like them a lot. It's 20 years of punk, you know. I like people who have another side to the music than just the straight ahead.
Right. Thank you very much for talking with us.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Record producer Phil Ramone. His recent albums include the cast recording of Stephen Sondheim's Passion and Frank Sinatra's two albums of duets. Here's Frank Sinatra duetting with Frank Sinatra Jr.
My kind of town, Chicago is. My kind of town, Chicago is. My kind of people, too. People who, they all smile at you. And each time I roam, Chicago is
it's calling me home. Chicago is one town that'll never ever let you down. It's my kind of town.
This is Fresh Air.